coming up on this episode of Embracing Change with Lakrita Bowman and Jennifer Osborne.
And so I realized, I've only been out a week, and I realized already that there's a pull on me that if I don't do something for me, then that pull that I've been used to for so long is going to pull me back into that deep, dark hole.
Today, we're going to be talking about breaking the cycle of self-abuse. And for any listeners out there who are wondering where you can get this book, you can find it on Amazon. It will be available in Joseph Beth Booksellers locally in Cincinnati. And you could also email Lakrita or myself and get a copy through the mail that way as well. But just for those of you who may be listening somewhere out there in the country, you can get it on Amazon in both ebook and print edition. Chapter 5, we're going to pick up there. The title of that chapter is called The Confrontation. The byline talks about that up until age 32, that the little girl behind the bars controlled your every move. What did you mean by that exactly, that that little girl was controlling what you were doing?
She was controlling it because she had gotten frozen in a time of pain. And so, though I was growing up chronologically, year after year, there was a five-year-old little girl who found out that her identity was not what she perceived to be, because she found out at five that her mother had given her away, and she just created this defense mechanism and how she was going to protect herself. Mm-hmm. And so I may have grew up chronologically in age, but developmentally, I was still that five-year-old little girl. And she was running my life out of the pain and the confusion and the lack of true identity that she was experiencing. So that's what that meant. And so she also then experienced at the age of seven sexual abuse, rape, from her foster mom's boyfriend. So that was another layer of pain. And then at the age of 12, when she went in front of the judicial system of juvenile for a judge, Judge Black, she also then experienced another level of betrayal when an authority figure said that she would be only sent away for 30 days and ended up being somewhere for 2.5 years forgotten. Mm-hmm. So those layers of pain, you know, those experiences were just layers of on top, well, you know, whether it was betrayal, distrust, pain, confusion, feeling thrown away, feeling not important, not valued. And so she was running my life, and she was the dictator. She was the director of the story. Nobody can be trusted. Mm-hmm. We can only trust ourselves. We are armored. And no one's going to hurt our heart or our mind. And we have weapons, manipulation, lying, stealing, consistent saying the self-prophecy that we must depend on only us. There's no one else in the world you can trust but you. So that's what that meant.
Did you feel like you had her at those different layers in her maturity? Or was it literally like the emotional growth stopped right at five, even though you had these other experiences that happened at seven and 12?
I think that, no, she was developed. She was, you know, people call them now in our ego, you know, an ego is nothing but edging God out, right? Mm-hmm. So if I edge God out, that means that regardless to what God had already prepared for my life, my ego, my alter ego took over. Because there's no way that there's a God that would allow these things to happen. So I think my ego grew larger with every incident. Hmm. But I think the five-year-old little girl, the alter ego became pain. And so when that ego came up, edge got out, there's no God, you know, nobody could, you know, there could not be something bigger than you in the world or in the universe that would allow these things to happen to you. So ego is just nothing but edging God out. So I think as every experience happened, I think I edged God out a little more. So by the time I was 14, in those experiences, there was no God for me. I was God and God only. So I had created my own God. Then I had edged God in me, and only me could take care of me, nothing outside of me.
One of the quotes that you had in that chapter was, "Now I wanted to feel the pain and not run, but grow from it. I wanted to be able to rise above my hurt and not have to medicate it." So when you got that realization of the little girl, and then you got the realization of you were ready to really feel that pain, where were you in that? And how did you jump off into, okay, I'm going to really let the walls down and experience that pain?
Well, I think in the last podcast, I talked a little bit about the voice, then seeing the vision. So by this time, I'm talking about I had been, you know, released from prison, I think, and at this point, and I'm talking about when I go to my probation officer. I think I talked about that the last episode, and she didn't know what to do. And then they say, well, if you really want some help, you know, you come back tomorrow. And, you know, one thing led to another. And I think that all of those barriers and all of those hurdles were part of the opportunities to see if I was going to be sincere. And so when you ask, where was I, what did that mean to want to face that pain, not run from it? I think I had an opportunity from the day I told my probation officer that I wanted help, and I didn't really know what that looked like. And she looked at me and said, my only job is to make sure you get a job, stay out of prison, right, getting you help. What does that mean? You know, and I say, well, you know, the judge said if I come back in front of him, I was going to do all my time. And so I realized I've only been out a week, and I realized already that there's a pull on me that if I don't do something for me, then that pull that I've been used to for so long is going to pull me back into that deep, dark hole. Mm. And so I said to her, I need to know, is there people who can help me try to not go back to prison? And so in that moment, when she went and got her supervisor, I think that whether I knew it or not, there is, for me, I've learned over the years now that there's windows of opportunity and possibilities. And I think either we climb through the window when it's open, or we stay on the outside of it and we have to wait again till the Kairos and the Chronos time meet. And if you don't know what that means, listeners, that means there's a chronological time and there's a spiritual time. And they kiss and things happen. And I think for me, there was a chronological moment and a Kairos moment. They were coming together when I went to that probation officer. And so what I would say is that when I didn't want to run from the pain anymore, I wanted to maybe look and see how I could research what was really going on with me. And I can't even be, to be totally naked and unashamed, I can't even say for me, it was me that was doing it. It was something deeper in me that was pushing me towards a direction that I had to accept it, but I can't really take total credit for it. I think that as we talk more, I will take more responsibility for it. But in the beginning, I can't take responsibility. I think it's almost like the lines of, they talk about now and about, you know, the universe lines up. I think that the universe was lining up for me. Now, I still had the free will and the choice, but something even bigger than me was pushing me toward the universe that was lining up, if that makes sense. And so when I went that day, I think not running was telling the probation officer that I really wanted the help, being willing to go home that night to my sister's home and come back the next morning, and then them telling me that in order for you to go to the program in Cincinnati, you have to be ordered by the judge. And then not only ordered by the judge, you have to therefore be court ordered into this program. So now I'm no longer going to run away. I got to run into the very thing that I didn't want to be in. So there was a very, to me, a crossover moment, or it was a pivotal moment, if that's understandable. Like, okay, am I going to really come back tomorrow, go in front of the judge, and go to jail? When I came to you because I didn't want to be in jail anymore. What does that all look like?
Was that a vulnerability to a degree of...
I'm sure it was. I didn't know it was, though. But I'm sure it was looking back. Yeah. I'm telling you, it was something greater than me, working for me, in me, that I now know was not me, but it was the him in me.
Yeah.
That was coming forth out of me to get me to where he had already purposed me to be.
But you had to make that choice.
I still had to be willing. I still had, when people talk about free will, I still had to say yes. He wasn't forcing me, but there was something stronger in me. The yes was stronger than the no, and the yes was stronger than the comfort.
We know the enemy always tries to derail us from following after what God is leading us into. So what were some of the things that you were maybe hearing in that you could have walked the other way?
Well, I think it wasn't even about hearing. It was about choice. In that moment when she said, we found a place where the judge has to order you in it, and so you need to come back tomorrow morning again, and we have a court docket, we have you on the docket, and the judge will, so bring your toothbrush, bring your stuff, because you'll go to jail from that. He'll be ordering you into the program, and then you'll have to wait. The bed could come in a week, it could come in a month, it could come in 2 months. We don't know when it's coming. So I think just the indecisiveness. So that whole night, you know, going back home to my sister's house was, I would say, a moment of reckoning. It's like, was I going to get up the next morning and go? And I remember walking. My sister lived on Front Street. The court is also on Front Street and Court Street. All of it. Hamilton is very small. And I just remember it probably was only a couple, maybe I could walk from my sister's house to the courthouse in about 5 minutes. So even in that, I would say that I didn't have a long journey, that the decision was only 5 minutes away. And I remember walking past the church I grew up in, Payne Chapel, that morning. And I remember just looking at everything and thinking, am I really going to go turn myself in for the possibility of jail? And I said to myself, it's better to go spend time than it is to do time. So I'm just going to go spend some time now, see what happens.
Which is different than how you'd ever experienced your time
before.
Yeah.
And so that day I went in front of Judge Vallon, and Judge Nadel concurred, and they ordered me to Talbert House here in Cincinnati. And I spent 6.5 weeks waiting on that bed. I went into that jail I think I got out on the 9th originally of August. So it was a week later. So the 16th, I think it was like the 18th of August of 1992. And I didn't get the bed until the 28th day of September. And so I began to reckon. I believe I began to have moments in the cell. You know, it was different. Even the jail seemed different. I had been in jail most of my life, but it was like an open space this time. It wasn't the confinement. And I began to read the Bible. I didn't understand it, but I began, it was the only book in there. We didn't have a library, so I began to read the Bible. Like I said, didn't have really a comprehension to it. It was just a book and some stories. And it just was different. And so when you say run away from pain, I think I was running into the opportunity and not running from the pain. I didn't know that there was so much more pain to face, but there was.
Yeah. You go into that a little bit as you're making the choice to make your changes. You talked about how you realized you had a poor self-worth and how you had felt abandonment Mm-hmm. And you had to really face those head on. And that one of the insights you were given was you were looking through the lens of abandonment and you were looking through the lens of poor self-worth, mm-hmm. and how those became a choice and how you started viewing things. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there are lots of people out there that struggle with bad self-worth and, you know, abandonment. And
people would ask, when you say lenses, we always think about glasses. But if you deal with the eye, the optical of your eye, and if you were to really look at it from the optician, I guess is what he's called, the eye doctor. He talks about when he puts that light in your eye, there's a lens that he's looking at. And it goes into the cord of your brain, mm-hmm. and it sends a signal. And so in your hippocampus is where your memory is. The only thing that goes in there is pain and passion, nothing else. And so what was happening for me was, I've learned, is that when the lenses that I had been looking at life with was through pain. And so I believe that I, you know, because I know now I'm 20-something years away from it, so there's another journey to talk about in the future. And yet, looking back, what was happening was, I believe God was changing the lens from pain to purpose to passion. Hmm. And so, but he had to, the life that I had lived, I had to go back and look at the pain and then exchange the pain lenses for purpose and then passion. And that's why I believe I am where I am today, because my lenses changed. So I began to look at the situations, and I began to feel it. There's a difference, I've learned through life now, that there's a difference between, if you cut yourself, there is a natural nervous system that tells your brain, I'm in pain. But emotional pain can sit under the layer of something that you don't even know and recognize, because it almost cuts the emotional nerve off. And so you block it psychologically. You exchange it. You make a new reality. And that reality becomes your survival reality. So in order to go back and deal with those painful situations, you've got to put your weapons down, your perceptions down. You got to be so vulnerable. And then you have to have someone on the outside of you to guide you back into that place you had abandoned. And so for me, it was my psychologist, Nancy Smith Gosselin, who helped me go back into that place and let me see some of the psychological, emotional trauma damage that I had exchanged my reality to. So that's how she helped me change my lenses. She let me see. She's like, let's talk about this. Through a lot of questions, through how did you get to that decision? Who told you that? Where did that come from? How did that feel? What was the outcome?
Like really questioning what you accepted as being absolute truth is not necessarily being an absolute truth.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's just the perceptions of the little girl that you were in the moment you experienced it.
Exactly. Exactly.
And so, the lies you told yourself.
Exactly. That became my truth.
Yeah.
And I lived by those truths for years. And so they were my core beliefs. So we had to go back in and exchange some of my core belief system, which is very difficult for most people.
Yeah.
If there's a test that you can do about change, that it's a five angle piece that you can do. And most people never get past one and two. And someone who knows me well and has done this before tells me all the time, you're very rare when it comes to this kind of trauma, that you're at a level five. It's like a level five change that doesn't, usually a person can get from maybe one to two, or maybe even two to three. But usually when they get to three, they have finally got to a place that at least they're not doing what they used to do. They're not going to prison or doing drugs or doing this, and they have settled their lives as being good, which it is compared to
what they had. Yeah.
But when you can get to a level five, that means you're continually growing, continually developing, continually looking at what can I do better? How can I do it better? Not for better forsaking yourself, but better because you know there got to be a deeper level truth that you may have missed back here. So it's a developmental truth now. Things like going to school and college, where if you didn't go or if you were there, because I got my education in prison and all that, but did I really listen? Did I really understand politics? Did I really understand diversity? Did I really understand leadership? Did I really understand taking on responsibilities? So now, even if I'm now 59, going back into the school and going to a deeper level of development, not just to stay out of prison no more. See what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Not just to not do drugs, not just to be okay with the world, but because now I want to know all the things I could have known but didn't know, but now I want to know, and it's best for me to know. So when I understand it and I'm presented with it, whatever situation I'm in, I'm able to at least have the seat at the table and have the understanding. So it's a deeper level five. Like, okay, she's going through another level. It's a whole different development now. It's not just about getting away from the behavior choices. It's about developing the internal self for the external experiences to give to herself and to other people. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. It's going beyond just enough to change. It's like continually getting in a habit or a rhythm of always asking, mm-hmm. always.
Is there something more?
Yeah.
Did I miss something? Can I go and regain that which I could have had but chose not to, and now I want to because I want to be able to be the best version. I don't want to leave anything on the table.
And that's really like a lot of work, but it's mm-hmm. worth it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that look at where you are now and how God has used you and in so many people's lives and had impact. It's just in that continually
yeah.
asking and continuing to go beyond just enough. Because I think we as people, it's super tempting to just do enough.
Yeah.
I'm just going to change enough to be okay.
To be a good person.
Or be a good person, right.
Or it's, to make people think I'm a good person.
Right. But yeah. it's that extra level
mm-hmm.
of really saying, okay, I'm going to take it beyond just things are okay for me.
I'm good.
I'm all right.
I'm not going to prison. I'm not
right.
doing drugs. I got a pretty decent pay. You know, I could make it in this world, maneuver, and be okay.
Yeah.
But it's like, no, I want to know more because who else out there may need what I need to know
yeah.
that I have yet to meet? And who else? And then what are some of the core beliefs that I believe or ignorance? Not even core beliefs, just out of lack of knowledge. The Bible said my people perish out of lack of knowledge. That's out of ignorance. So why should I not go prepare myself because I just need to know because I don't want to be ignorant when I'm voting or when I'm looking at different, when things are happening in the criminal justice system. You know, I used to think that it was just me. But now I've learned it was. But there was also a system out there that was created to keep me in it.
Designed, yeah.
It was designed that way. And I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Because all I thought was just I was committing crimes and going to prison. And I was. And yet, the statistic says it was obvious that I would probably go anyway as an African-American woman. So, but I didn't know it. So I was making their job real easy. But it was already designed that way. Now I want to educate people that I work and serve with even to a greater level. So I push myself to learn more about abortions, about, you know, where did it come from? Where did slavery come from? Slavery didn't come from a white man. It came because of people wanting to profit. And it really was the economical system in Europe and in different places like that. So we look at the white man and decide it was the white man's fault. But was it really? You know, when you look deeper into those things, you realize, I didn't know what I didn't know until I know it. Now I'm studying things that I never thought was interesting. And now I'm finding it very interesting.
Now that you have the knowledge, there's also a responsibility. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't run from that knowledge once you know it, right? You can't unknow something.
Exactly.
So it's a matter of, okay, you got to make a choice now of as to what to do with that knowledge now that you're enlightened.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of, oh, I can just forget about that and keep going this way.
No, so. And I can't. I have to keep growing. And I think even in the beginning, as you talk about in chapters 5, 6, and 7, they all got me to this moment. Being willing not to run anymore. Being willing to embrace. Being willing to understand I didn't know how. And asking for the help I needed. Asking for, you know, being willing to be, as we call it now, vulnerable enough. I didn't know it was vulnerability then. You know, I just knew I was so desperate. Desperation will make you vulnerable too.
Yeah.
But then it comes a time you have to learn what vulnerability is in a bigger way. So.
In a healthier way.
In a healthier. You know what I mean? That vulnerability doesn't make you weak. It makes you strong. But at that point, my vulnerability was out of desperation. I was so not wanting to go back to prison. But I just didn't know how not to. So I needed someone who either didn't ever go or had information that I didn't have to teach me what I needed to know and teach me how to learn it so I can start applying it, so I can then put it in action, and so I can live by it.
You've been listening to the Embracing Change podcast. Music production and mastering by Gone Coastal Productions. Podcast editing and production by Jennifer Osborne. Podcast copyright 2020 by Lakrita Bowman.